take a minute to check your social battery. How's it doing? It's easy to ignore our needs and spread ourselves too thin. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/popcastpod today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/popcastpod.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your entry-level psychedelia of music news and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica. You know who that is. It's a little band called The Beatles. That's Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. That is the opening track from the album, the 1967 album of the same name, celebrating its 50th anniversary this month. And I'm here with a man who has been there for all 50 of those years.
I've been listening to this thing for 50 years.
All 50 of those years. That's John Pareles, chief pop music critic of the New York Times.
Hi there.
John, anniversaries are...
I hate anniversaries.
They're bunk.
They're bunk. They're an excuse to mostly trot out familiar ideas, you know, to
familiar product.
Familiar product, received wisdom galore. So I've tended to avoid them.
Like, this has not been a thing that we've ordinarily spent a lot of time on. I think because, like you say, most anniversaries are marketing opportunities and moments in which ideas that have, I don't want to say have already been settled, but have at least already been shared are kind of brought back into the fore to say, hey, here's an idea.
I can't tell you how much of these same pieces of Beatles trivia I read across newspapers worldwide about this album because they're all from the same couple of sources of the people who were there who have been widely quoted and disseminated for decades.
And doesn't that in and of itself make it more challenging, especially with this many years, to really assess an album on its own terms? Because by the 50-year anniversary of something, we're assessing its creation, its initial reception, its long-term reception, its narrative that has been built up by participants and creators.
And all the contrarians, all the giant killers.
Backlashes to backlashes.
Yeah.
So at some point, the album is gone.
It's not gone yet. It's still there. I mean, the test of a durable piece of art is, do you still want to listen to it?
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of the first albums I bought. You know, I was a high school kid.
Mm-hmm.
This was actually the first hype I remember.
Mm.
This album was going to change the world. You know, it was ballyhooed. I think that was part of the reason Richard Goldstein's 1967 New York Times review was so, oh, no, it's not that good. Because everybody... Hype was pretty new.
Yes, it was the Little Yachty's Teenage Emotions of 1967.
There you go.
And Richard Goldstein was the Joe Budden.
Yes, there you go. But why not listen to it now? I thought of it as a relic. I mean, I compared it to a Fabergé egg in this story. I really think it's this amazing piece of workmanship and craftsmanship that nobody would do now.
Was it a Fabergé egg in its time?
It was pretty much the most elaborate pop production the world had ever known. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, compared
to... Pet Sounds was right before that.
Pet Sounds is before it.
Yeah.
Pet Sounds is shorter.
Take that, Brian.
By about 10 minutes, I think. Frank Zappa's Freak Out was actually an end-to-end concept album, unlike Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, which is sort of a good excuse to throw together a bunch of very varied songs.
Right. I think the only reason that I have historically found anniversaries useful is... it creates an opportunity not just to potentially rewrite a narrative about a record, but it also allows you to think a lot about the time in which one particular piece of art was created up against other periods of time, up against the present. And I was doing some reading in some of these pieces. I'm sure that all the same sources are quoted, but I was doing some reading about Sgt. Pepper's, and I was very struck by how much of what I was reading about the album's creation, both in the studio and also how the Beatles were being received in the world at that time, outside, by fans and by critics, how much it reminded me of the present moment. All the studio tinkering, obviously this is like studio tinkering 1.0 in a lot of cases with this record. But also, I was reading something funny that there was a 5 or 6 month gap in between the Beatles had come off their previous tour for Revolver and this record came out, or maybe when the singles came out before the record, and that people were basically like, yo, the Beatles are washed.
Yeah, they're over now.
They're washed. And that sounds very internet-y to me. That's like, you know, you disappear for a minute and people are like, oh, you're washed. Like, that never coming back. So it was very almost comforting, perversely, to know that this was all happening in 1967 as well. What were the Beatles answering? Because the Sgt. Pepper's feels like an answer record.
Well, yeah, they're answering Pet Sounds. I mean, Brian Wilson brought in orchestral arrangements, the bass harmonica and lovely Rita Meter made, you know, a homage to Brian Wilson's bass harmonica use on Pet Sounds, stuff like that. But I think they were answering the idea that we're not just writing a 3-minute verse chorus bridge song about teenage love. And they'd already started to do that. I mean, right. There's some pretty wacky stuff on Revolver. Tomorrow Never Knows is tape loops and weirdness and the Tibetan Book of the Dead. So it's not like they weren't ambitious before, but I think they just stepped back, said, we're going off the road. They took a deep breath. Rock bands didn't do that. You know, they were out playing, you know, more high school dances because their managers wanted the money. I mean, to like step back, go into the studio, say, we're going to really work on something big was different.
Well, and this is also part of the Beatles shift from live band to studio band.
Yeah, they didn't play live again until they played on the roof for Let It Be.
Mm-hmm. And so the Beatles, 12 months before this, or 24 months before this, what kind of band was that band?
That band was a band that was playing for girls who were screaming so loud they couldn't hear themselves play.
Right.
And it must have frustrated the hell out of them. I mean, they were real musicians. They wanted to play well. They all had great ears. Mm-hmm. So to be slogging across America, jumping into limousines, and then playing your short set for people who were screaming over it, cannot have been a satisfying artistic experience.
Sounds lit, though.
But there was also the Bigger Than Jesus controversy.
Yes. And this is in 1966.
Yeah, John Lennon gave an interview to a friend at a British paper, someone who had been covering him a long time.
No journalists or friends.
Exactly. But the Brits ignored this because he said, you know, we're bigger than Jesus now. Religion may or may not last. Religion's been perverted by its latter-day codifiers. He'd been reading, like, books about religion.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, then you take out the soundbite, Twitter-size quote.
See? Just like today.
We're bigger than Jesus now. And you apply that to the Ku Klux Klan and every fundamentalist church in America, and suddenly the Beatles are anathema. So, you know, there had been record burnings. There was protests. It wasn't a happy way to end your touring career.
Let's talk a little bit about what's happening in the rest of the world. I mean, summer 1967 is the summer of love. This is the beginning.
This is June 67.
June 67. We're at the sort of entry point into basically up through Altamont, kind of.
Well, 68 was pretty turbulent. 67 really was this flowers and bunnies and rainbows moment that didn't last. And Sgt. Pepper appeared right at that moment, ringed with this halo of joy. I mean, the Beatles have been doing acid for a couple of years. you know, so, I mean, it's not like, it wasn't a surprise to them. But the rest of the world was catching up. I mean, the Summer of Love, I mean, there were hippies in San Francisco in 1965 and 66. So the Summer of Love was basically when it
the culmination of all that stuff.
Yeah, it was like the third year of Burning Man. You know?
Right. Let's talk. Okay, so speaking of acid, let's play Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. Let's listen to a little bit of that, a song that may or may not be about psychedelic drugs.
Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. Picture yourself on a train. With plasticine pauses, with looking glass ties. Suddenly someone is.
We'll take a quick break right now. Back at you in a sec.
The new Starz series, Mary and George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true. But shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son George on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. The show is full of wit, scandal, action. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Starz and the Starz app.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with a first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
The Beatles are always saying, oh, it's this drawing by Julian Lennon,
yeah, sure.
Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. There's a documentary with the box set that they're still saying, oh, it wasn't about LSD, it wasn't about LSD, which I reply, nonsense.
Right. I mean, it was weird going back and reading a bunch of things from different points in history. You see this tension between the Beatles still wanting to give kind of like PR-approved answers that would facilitate their careers in the 60s and 70s with kind of like a little bit of historical, like, come on now, guys. And they sort of, I think even individually, they kind of toggle back and forth, depending who's asking and when the asking is being asked. A thing that's striking, and this is true on Revolver somewhat, but I feel like it's more true on Sgt. Pepper's, is the range of music. And the range of sonnet, the range of song influence. And you have sort of like very traditional British
music hall.
And then you have something like Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds or...
Or Within You Without
Within
You,
Without which You, I was just going to say.
Indian.
Yeah. It's funny because listening back to it, I'm thinking, well, this is an inconsistent record. Maybe I'm on my Richard Goldstein. But I'm like, this is an inconsistent record. How is this record coherent?
I'm not sure it is coherent.
Okay. Did that matter at the time?
Well, it works, though, to me. Do you really feel like it has thudding lows?
No, I just feel like the palette changes pretty rapidly.
Yeah, but I think that was the whole idea. I mean, the girl with kaleidoscope eyes is the girl listening, the palette's supposed
to
change.
Are you saying mental palettes were also changing pretty rapidly?
Yeah. But that's its charm, and they were... it was forward into the past, basically. I mean, they were going back to music hall. They were going back to kind of a vaudeville soft shoe. I mean, there's lots of it's very retro. I mean, if the Summer of Love was all about our great utopian future, the Beatles were saying, "Wait a minute, there's all this past to deal with."
Before we get super deep on Sgt. Pepper, should we actually stop and talk about Penny Lane and Strawberry Fields Forever, which came out of those initial sessions and which were kind of like cleaved off into their own thing and not put on this album, although, as you point out, they're on this most recent reissue.
They were part of the project.
Right.
And I think because the Beatles had been off the radar for so many months.
Mm-hmm. So many months.
So many minutes.
Can you imagine? I mean, you imagine Frank Ocean in the 60s? He'd been gone for 12 years, probably.
Well, the Axl Rose solo album. I mean, But the Beatles had been gone for so long that the record company was saying, oh, we need a single. And it's like, okay, we've got two finished songs, Strawberry Fields and Penny Lane. You can have them for a two-sided single, which is one of the greatest two-sided singles of history, in my humble opinion, even though I am a baby boomer.
Let's listen to Penny Lane, because I think it does set the table a little bit for what's to come.
Penny Lane, there is a barber showing photographs of every head he's had the pleasure to know. Him behind his back, and the banker
So Penny Lane is not on the more experimental end of the spectrum of what these sessions end up producing.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, it's got a Baroque piccolo trumpet on it that Paul McCartney saw on a Brandenburg Concerto performance. It doesn't sound like a rock and roll song.
No.
It's more like, I don't know, a theater song maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Broadway musical kind of song. But it does have that Baroque trumpet in it. And what the hell are they talking about? You know, the barber shaves another customer, you know, the fireman rushing in. It's you don't even know what's going on, really.
Mm-hmm.
So it's got this sort of very psychedelic time sense going on in it. But the way they tell the story is John Lennon wrote Strawberry Fields Forever, which was a reminiscence for him about a place in Liverpool. And then Paul McCartney said, oh, I better write my reminiscence of my place in Liverpool.
Mm-hmm.
So they were still, you know, one-upping each other.
Let's talk a little bit about the Lennon and McCartney dynamic at this point in the Beatles' development. How are they jockeying for position against each other? Forget against the Beach Boys. How are they jockeying for position against each other?
Well, McCartney describes it as competition, as like, you know, if you do this, that's an idea I can bounce off of. That's the whole, like, writing Penny Lane after Strawberry Fields.
Mm.
They did also fill in each other's blanks, because McCartney was happy and Lennon was savage. McCartney writes, it's getting better all the time, and Lennon writes, can't get no worse. They have a good sweet and sour dynamic going.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how much they were sitting in a room working together. I suspect it was more bringing pieces of what each of them had done, which, I mean, A Day in the Life is a John Lennon song with the Paul McCartney interlude.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, so what's sort of an emblematic Lennon moment on this album?
A Day in the Life, really. I mean, he saw a newspaper story and, you know, he blew his mind out in a car with some rich person who may or may not have been in the House of Lords was found dead.
Mm-hmm.
And Lennon constructed this monumental hymn, but it needed something peppy in the middle, and he had McCartney woke up, got out of bed, dragged a comb across my head.
Right.
So you had this, they still had chemistry. And I think they were still probably a really good quality control check on each other.
So let's listen to a little Day in the Life.
Found my way upstairs and had a smoke, and somebody spoke and I went into a dream.
So McCartney...
But I also have this. A Day in the Life is just a monumental way to end a record.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, there were like 9, I think, pianos and organs playing that last mm-hmm. chord. And as the reverberations of the chord diminished, the engineer kept turning it up so it goes on for so long. All this is done by hand on analog equipment on 4-track tape.
Right.
I mean, the whole insane nuttiness of the way this album was recorded in incredibly primitive conditions in 5 months,
mm-hmm.
when, you know, we've got Pro Tools and people take years figuring out their drum sound. You got to love these guys.
How radical were those studio innovations and the jiggering in its time? How radical and how were they received? Was it received as heretical, or was it received as, oh, finally, someone's figured this out?
I think it was more like, wow, you know, you can make this sound. I mean, Strawberry Fields is this insane construction of 2 versions of the song played in 2 different keys, and one's with the sort of the whiny strings and one's with more of a rock band, and the engineer somehow managed to put them together, which, you know, you could do now on Pro Tools by time shifting or whatever, pitch shifting, and but then it's like a guy with a razor blade and magnetic tape putting together 2 completely incompatible things to make this weird sonic landscape that no one had ever heard before. Pet Sounds seems to be pretty much orchestral arrangements with the band. And this involved a lot more bizarre tape manipulation.
Right.
They were doing one-upmanship again.
And no one else was doing that at
the time. Frank Zappa was doing
Zappa,
it.
Zappa, yeah.
And they were both looking toward the European avant-garde, toward Varese and Stockhausen. Stockhausen's on the cover
yes.
of Sgt. Pepper.
How do you feel the McCartney moments and the Lennon moments differentiate themselves on this record? What do you hear in the McCartney moments that you don't hear in the Lennon stuff?
I mean, Lennon always has a cynical undertone. Lennon's a little more skeptical of the whole thing. McCartney is like, it's getting better all the time, and I'm fixing a hole, and the hole's going to be fixed, and, you know, painting the room in colorful ways, and Lennon's going, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Lennon is for the benefit of Mr. Kite, which is taken from a Victorian circus poster that has been documented and analyzed, and people know who Pablo Fanke is. You know, that's the problem with writing about Sgt. Pepper is all this stuff has been so thoroughly researched. I mean, all the archaeology has been done and redone. But art, if it's going to last, should still speak to us. And to me, this does, but it speaks of its own incredible towering ambition. Man, to spend 5 months and $100,000 on an album, can you imagine?
Well, okay, so just for, for context, how long did it take usually to make albums for a group like this in that time
period? They usually took a couple of weeks, I think.
Right.
I have no idea how they did it. The productivity of all of these bands, of Dylan, of the Beatles, of the Rolling Stones, because they were on tour all the time.
Did some of that have to do with the fact that there really wasn't much studio trickery to really do?
Sure.
And so therefore, you went, you knocked out the tracks, and you laid down the performance, then that was that. And then maybe someone fudged with it a little bit, and then maybe then, but that's the end of the story.
Yeah,
but also, today, everything is sort of an endless, it's a puzzle that never quite finishes. I mean, you have someone like Kanye saying, like, I'm a finish Wolves on an album that's already like in the world. And he's like, that song's actually not finished, FYI.
Whereas, and then you can do the remix.
Yeah, but back then it was just like, well, no, we recorded it and it's done and now it's out.
Well, I also think that bands are so much more geared to performing live. The way they heard the song in their heads was, what can the four of us play on a stage? And that was the radical break the Beatles made with Revolver, really, was to say, oh, we don't have to do that. You know, we can have seagulls on tape loops.
Right.
And Sgt. Pepper was an extension of that, but was to say the studio is a different world. The studio is not a field recording. The studio is an instrument.
Right.
And they weren't the first to do this. I mean, you know, Les Paul, Phil Spector, whatever. But for a working rock and roll band to do this was pretty damn radical.
Especially one this popular.
Yeah.
You know,
like how dare they stop writing teenage love songs?
Well, but I mean, do you think that they were consciously putting their popularity at risk in order to do this?
I think they just wanted to do it. I don't think they were trying to downsize their career at all.
You don't think that?
No. I think that this was where in these incredibly accelerated times. I mean, it's what, 4 years? Since She Loves You, Yeah, Yeah, Yeah. I mean, it's astonishing to me. I just think it was where they wanted to go. Packaged in the 50th anniversary boxed set is a documentary from the 25th anniversary. but it has this interesting bit where, I mean, where they're talking about George Martin, their producer. And in the early days, he was the guy in a suit. He was the adult in the room. And by the time they get to Sgt. Pepper, he's the guy saying, oh, you know, they've had some really good ideas. I'm going to go with them and accomplish them. He becomes the facilitator instead of—
He's executing the vision.
I mean, that must have been quite a mind change, though he had been making comedy records, so that was why the Beatles liked him in the first place.
Let's talk a little bit about the period of time before the recording. So everybody splits up, and after that tour, everybody splits up and does their own thing.
Yeah, they go see the world. I mean,
right.
McCartney goes to Kenya.
Harrison goes to India.
Right. They really wanted to not be Beatles for a while.
Right. And they brought some of that back. Should we listen to Within You, Without You?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so let's listen a little bit of that. Okay, so that's George Harrison playing the sitar? Is that what that is?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's, you know, another, you know, quiet little bit of how did they do this? They had British musicians and Indian musicians who have different scales under their fingers, and they sound totally compatible. I mean, Harrison wasn't just sort of dropping in the sound of the sitar as a special effect. He was using Indian scales.
And he had gone to study with Ravi Shankar.
Yeah. Apparently the rest of the Beatles weren't even involved with this track.
Oh, is that true?
It was just Harrison and musicians. But sounds good to me. I mean, Richard Goldstein is right that the lyrics are kind of flat-footed, but on the other hand, it's a great song.
At that time, was anybody else experimenting globally along those ways?
This was pretty out there. I mean, Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, other rock groups were into him and were probably getting some kind of drone thing going on. But this kind of begins what we now think of as psychedelia with, you know, big, long, endless drones. It was in the avant-garde. People had heard Indian music, and the avant-gardists were also getting into drones. And it was totally pretentious, and it should have just been three-chord rock and roll forever, say the Giant Killers. It wasn't a bad thing to be erudite in the psychedelic era.
Sure. So anyone who follows the podcast knows that I'm a dedicated mono listener, obviously. I spend a lot of my time seeking out the mono recordings of all my favorite classic rock albums.
What?
Okay. But a thing that I was struck by when I was looking around, there's remixes and remasters, and I found it very difficult to get to the bottom of a song. And it felt like every because to me, a remaster is an opinion, a remix or whatever they're called. They're
really
opinions.
Two different things. Yeah, they're definitely opinions.
Yeah,
they're,
and I'm not sure I want an opinion. But what's the deal, man? What's the haps?
It's horrible historical revisionism. The story goes that the Beatles took so much time doing the mono version of Sgt. Pepper, which, of course, once stereo came in, nobody ever listened to, that they had to rush through the stereo remix. And the stereo remix, the stereo mix, not remix, right, original mix, is pretty odd. All the Beatles stereo mixes on the early albums are pretty odd because a lot of things are panned hard left and hard right. You have the entire vocal in your right ear and you have the drums in your left ear. Brian Eno loved this. It was great inspiration to him, but it's very odd through headphones because you have things like way off to the left. And you also had the limitations of tape. They only had four tracks. So I think there was a lot of, we're going to record this stuff, then we're going to re-record it to another track, then we're going to build on top of it.
Yeah.
This builds up tape hiss.
Yeah, and you're losing stuff in the process.
You're losing stuff. So
it's like Xeroxing a Xerox, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not perfect digital sound.
Right.
So Giles Martin, the son of George Martin, who's been doing a lot of Beatles tomfoolery, like the Cirque du Soleil mashups, got to go into the original tapes and I think take them apart a little more. So I'm very torn because, you know, before I started writing about this, I hadn't listened to Sgt. Pepper in at least a decade and probably 10, 15, possibly 20 years. I knew every note.
Yeah, sure.
Because it was one of the first records I got in high school and I just listened to it and listened to it. Every note came back. So I'm used to things like the slight blurriness of it.
Yeah.
And when you listen to
it's a feature, not a bug.
Well, but they did give you the mono 1967 in the box. So you can still have your blurry mono mix if you want. And of course, you still have all the other stereo remasters, which are different from remixes. I mean, this gave him a lot more room to play around and move things and basically separate things. So if you're a music geek like me, and you want to kind of figure out what the second French horn was playing during Sgt. Pepper, that's kind of cool.
It is like, it's like the stems in modern parlance.
Yeah.
It's like giving you access to the stem files.
Right.
Yeah.
So you can see how it was done. I mean, and I kind of want to watch how the gears in that watch fit together.
Right.
So,
but your memories, I imagine, are like very specifically attuned, like you say, to that original version.
Listening to it on a crappy stereo, too.
Right. Sure.
People from the 60s heard a lot of their music on really bad transistor radios, which sound kind of almost like MP3s.
I guess. sick burn.
So
I personally don't get too caught up in debates. Yeah, or vice versa, debates about authenticity and about like what the real listening experience should be or was. But when I see this happening, when I see this kind of piece-by-piece dismantling of something that I imagine most people have a very specific oral memory of.
It doesn't bother me, though, because you can still go online and download somebody who's, like, done a FLAC version of the original vinyl.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the American version did not have the gibberish in the end groove. And so I heard it wrong all these years. I heard an incomplete version. And they took 9 hours in the studio to babbling at the microphone and making noise and chopped it into what would be a 2-second endless end groove. which is on the Stereo Remix.
And those are not, and that was still in a time when the British version and an American version would be slightly different.
Yeah, that was the slight difference.
Right, not like an iTunes bonus track different, but like an actual difference of substance. So are there songs that you think are particularly well-suited to this kind of like dismantling, remantling?
With a Little Help from My Friends is a kind of a strange mix on the original. It starts out with the Beatles singing the Sgt. Pepper's refrain in one ear, I think it's the right ear, and then Billy Shears, Ringo, is in the left ear, and the Sgt. Pepper's chorus sort of moves into the middle of your head before it disappears and he takes over. So there's the contrast between the crazy loud lead guitar in Sgt. Pepper and the sort of more stately With a Little Help from My Friends, and the remix, to me, knits it together a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's a difference. It's a slight improvement to me, but I can still listen to the mono, and, you know, my memories are probably playing in my head anyway.
Should we go out on the remixed version, the newly mixed version of With a Little Help from My Friends?
Sure.
I mean, I would love to go out with your memory of the original version, but I don't think the technology's here yet. So let's go out with the remixed version of With a Little Help from My Friends.
What would you think if I sang out of tune? Would you stand up and walk out on me?
Thank you for listening to the New York Times Popcast. Thank you to my guest, John Perales, Chief Pop Music Critic of the New York Times, for talking about 50 years of Sgt. Pepper's memories. You can listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. You can email us which remastered version of which Sgt. Pepper song you prefer at podcast@nytimes.com. You can subscribe to the podcast, which is something you should absolutely do, at iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, wherever you get your audio content. Our producer is Pedro Rosado. We will be back next week.
Hello.